Iraq's President Ebrahim Raisi says sanctions, terrorism and war are major issues plaguing the world, all of which stem from unilateralism. A Pakistan High Court drops terrorism charges against former Prime Minister Imran Khan, saying his alleged offence doesn't justify such charges. And Moscow rejects Kiev's war crimes accusations, saying allegations of mass graves in a Ukrainian city are nothing but lies and fabrications. Hello and good morning. Welcome to World News. Thank you for joining us. Iran's president says sanctions, terrorism and war are the major issues plaguing the world today. Ebrahim Raisi says they are all the results of unilateralism and must be addressed through collective wisdom. Raisi made the remarks upon arrival in New York City, where he will make his debut at the UN General Assembly. The Iranian president said sanctions have become a weapon of choice in the hands of major powers to pressure other countries. Raisi said the countries targeted will naturally hit back, and so peace and security are threatened and nations harmed. The Iranian president noted that the United Nations should live up to its name and not be monopolized by powerful countries. He stressed that issues affecting the world should be settled through global participation. Earlier, we asked journalist and political analyst Elia Magnier about the importance of Raisi's visit to New York for the UN General Assembly. Here's what he had to tell us.
Importance of this visit, it comes just a few days after the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting, where the representative of half of the world were in one room and Iran had become an official part of the organization that calls also to end the U.S. unilateralism over the world. And President Raisi is in a position today to criticize again the U.S. unilateral and illegal sanctions on the Iranian population, which is the right of Iran to live in dignity without being under the harsh sanctions imposed by the U.S. So it is an opportunity for Iran to slam the U.S. sanctions again, and also to show to the world that it's possible to survive without the U.S. hegemony, even with very harsh U.S. sanctions.
The U.S. says it will blacklist three Iranian cargo planes for allegedly violating its sanctions on Russia. The U.S. Commerce Department says it will add the Boeing 747 airplanes to a list of planes believed to violate U.S. export controls. The move is part of Washington's sanctions over Russia's war in Ukraine. The Commerce Department claims the planes operated by Mahan Air, Qeshm Fars Air and Iran Air are transporting goods, including electronic items, to Russia. The three Iranian airlines are already subject to a variety of restrictions by the U.S. government. Iran is commemorating its National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980s war between Iran and Iraq. Iraq's War University has hosted a ceremony to recount the humanitarian impacts of the eight-year war. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Veniz, along with military attachés from different embassies, to attend this ceremony dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
A time to the 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire, we renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi-imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A Pakistani court has dropped terrorism charges against former Prime Minister Imran Khan. The charges are related to a speech by Khan in August. In it, he allegedly threatened police and judicial officers after one of his close aides was denied bail. According to his lawyers, the court said Khan's alleged offense didn't attract terrorism charges. But his case will remain intact and will now be tried in an ordinary court. Khan has denied that his remarks were meant as a threat. The former premier has faced several lawsuits since his ousting in April following a vote of no confidence won by opposition parties. Turning now to Ukraine, where the war is entering its seventh month, Moscow has rejected Kiev's claims committing war crimes in the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv after it fell into Russian hands. Moscow says the allegations of mass graves in the Ukrainian city are nothing but lies and fabrications. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said Moscow would stand up for the truth in the story. Last week, some 450 graves were discovered in a forest area after the Ukrainian army recaptured the strategic eastern city from Russian forces. President Vladimir Zelensky claimed that investigations of the site revealed signs of violent death, accusing Russia of committing war crimes. Moscow, however, has refuted the accusations of extrajudicial killings over there. Another damning report on big oil. Major oil companies have been found guilty yet again when it comes to their climate-related commitments. Although this doesn't surprise anyone, it puts into question the oversight on these energy conglomerates, from emissions to their energy green commitments. And now that they are making record profits, the heat is on for them to be held accountable and to follow through in preventing global warming.
Oil and gas, two commodities that have been at the center of news for months now, mainly due to the conflict in Ukraine. One of the criticisms leveled against these oil and gas giants are the record profits that they are raking in.
It is immoral for oil and gas companies to be making record profits from this energy crisis on the back of the poorest people and communities and at a massive cost to the climate.
Bombshell report, however, is putting the spotlight more on these oil companies, but for the wrong reasons. Like this headline: criticism intensifies after big oil admits gaslighting public over green aims, which goes on to say, fury as explosive files reveal largest oil companies contradicted public statements and wished bedbugs upon critical activists, like this one.
And here today, we're going to be out demanding that the City of London, which is responsible or oversees about 15% of fossil fuel funding, could actually very, very rapidly, you know, get this source of finance switched off and move towards a green economy.
Here are the opening statements of the Oversight Committee.
Today we are holding our third hearing in the committee's investigation into the fossil fuel industry's decades-long climate disinformation and greenwashing campaigns.
Big oil, namely ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP, are at the center of controversy again and yet again, lying about keeping in line with climate change restrictions.
But these executives refused to commit to real changes.
What kind of lies? Here's one example.
But it is more than having to change. We want to change. We want to change because it's the right thing for the world, and it's a tremendous business opportunity for BP.
It was not too long ago when these headlines and pictures were plastered on the front pages of newspapers around the world. Climate change alarm, code red for humanity. Yet these alarm bells fail to stop these big oil companies from advancing their agenda, making money at the expense of people for their shareholders. While these companies are making record profits, it is worth noting the economic costs of climate change. The global cost of adapting to the climate impacts is expected to grow $140 to $300 billion per year by the year 2030 and $280 to $500 billion per year by the year 2050.
When it comes to climate change, the lies and deceits are not restricted to big oil companies alone. Many corporations are also guilty of misleading the general public through a process called greenwashing. Greenwashing is when companies lie about following a green guideline when it comes to their production, no matter what industry they are in.
To get the full impact of what these energy conglomerates are doing, the bare facts need to be known. According to a report published by the Carbon Majors Database in 2017, just 100 of them have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since the year 1988. If fossil fuels continue to be extracted at the same rate over the next 28 years as they were between 1988 and 2017, global temperatures would rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. What is shocking is that these large corporations, like Exxon, knew about climate change almost 50 years ago. In 2015, it was revealed that Exxon understood the science before it became a public issue. It was called the Climate Deception Dossiers.
The reality of global warming began making front-page headlines nearly 30 years ago. That's when the world's largest fossil fuel companies launched a three-decade campaign to deceive the public and delay action on climate change.
The worst part about these findings was that ExxonMobil spent millions of dollars to promote misinformation about the issue. The goal? To sow doubt about climate change. Let that sink in. Because these dossiers revealed that the coalition of fossil fuel companies had launched a big communications effort to sow doubt. Their motto, victory will be achieved when the average person is uncertain about climate science. Then in 2019, it was reported that major global firms were accused of concealing their environmental impact. This included more than 700 companies like Facebook, Amazon, Tesco, and here we go again, ExxonMobil. Accused of lacking transparency over things like water shortages and deforestation. How these non-oil and gas companies do this is that they do what's called greenwashing, conveying a false impression that one's products are environmentally friendly or sound, when in essence they are not. And here are some of the companies that are guilty of this. Famous brands known the world over, claiming that they have gone green, but in essence they have not. Whether it was the Paris Climate Accord or COP26.
And we arrive at what I believe is the moment of truth.
Or John Kerry.
It is time to come together for future generations in ways that none of us really ever thought we might have an opportunity to do.
All of that appears to be on the shelf for now. With a lack of energy resources, European countries and the U.S. are scrambling to fill the shortages, even if it includes resorting to big CO2 emitters like fossil fuels.
A Yemeni human rights group has released a report on what it calls Saudi Arabia's violations of a UN-backed truce since its beginning in April. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more in this report.
Amid international calls for renewing the UN-brokered truce, the Yemeni Center for Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to release a report titled The Alleged Truce. The report highlights the Saudi-led coalition's violations of the UN agreement since it was brokered in April.
Saudi Arabia's violations were committed from the first day of the war, but they continued even under the UN truce. The most important violations were the non-compliance with the terms of the truce, which included reducing the number of scheduled flights and specifying only one destination instead of two, as well as the continued detention of fuel ships. There is a breach on the essence of the agreement.
The report says the Saudi-led coalition has committed over 14,000 violations, including waging 278 airstrikes, which led to the death of Yemeni civilians.
As a human rights center, we affirm that the most important violations are the loss of life. Unfortunately, during the truce, 70 Yemeni civilians, including women and children, were killed. The siege has also continued during the truce. This has caused the deaths of thousands of civilians due to the lack of fuel in hospitals.
Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sides in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say that temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation.
And the coffin of Queen Elizabeth II has been lowered into the British Royal Vault in Windsor Castle, where a further private service will be held. The Queen will be buried in St. George's Chapel alongside her father, King George II, the Queen's mother and her sister. Last year, Prince Philip, the Queen's husband, was also laid to rest there. Leaders and representatives of different countries attended her state funeral, which took place after 10 days of mourning. Monday has already been declared a public holiday. Elizabeth died on September 8th at the age of 96 after reigning more than 70 years as Britain's monarch. Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thanks for joining me.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
US immigration policies have forced desperate people to traverse inhospitable landscapes along the US-Mexico border. We're prepared for you an article written by Peter Jung. The piece is titled, The Other Death Valley. Hundreds of migrants are dying in remote Texas deserts. Eddie Canales can't forget the moment he saw the decomposed body of a young man in his 20s hanging from an oak tree on a South Texas ranch last September. The intense heat and humidity in this arid scrubland had quickly rotted his flesh to expose much of his skeleton, which had been at the scene for at least a week. Clearly visible in a graphic image the sheriff's office provided to the Guardian was the skull, lolling to one side, and both his feet are missing, probably eaten by wild animals. According to ID documents found, the man was from Mexico. Police explored the possibility it was a lynching, but concluded it was suicide. Eddie Canales, who runs the South Texas Human Rights Center, a non-profit organization based in Brooks County, Texas, working to put an end to the avoidable harsh deaths and reunite families with the remains of their loved ones, said, "Most of the bodies I encounter are already skeletonized," he added, "but this was particularly harrowing. That image will stay with me forever." Brooks County covers almost 1,000 square miles of sparse, brush-covered sandy ranchlands, not far from the eastern end of the U.S.-Mexico border, and is at the heart of a deadly migration crisis that is seeing desperate people die in record numbers. So high is the grim death toll that the surrounding region, spanning several Texas counties near the Rio Grande, has been called the Other Death Valley. Data bears out that terrible nickname. The Missing Migrants Project, an initiative by the Swiss-based International Organization for Migration, IOM, that tracks migrant deaths and disappearances globally, recorded 715 deaths of people trying to cross the U.S. border from Mexico in 2021. More than double the figure in 2015, making it the deadliest land crossing in the world. According to a report by the University of Texas's Strauss Center, of the four U.S. states along the border with Mexico, Texas has the longest stretch and the highest number of migrant deaths. Brooks County, where authorities recovered 119 bodies last year, has had more deaths than any other Texas county over the last three decades. Don White, county deputy sheriff, said, "We're struggling to deal with all the bodies." Last year, the county was provided with a mobile morgue by the state in response to the grisly human reaping. He said, "I recently had to pick up three fresh ones in a day." Outside experts believe that the U.S. federal immigration policies have exacerbated the tragedy, forcing migrants into ever more perilous crossings and leading refugee journeys, fleeing violence, persecution, and climate disaster, to an anguished dead end. Eva Moya, an associate professor at the University of Texas studying the precarity faced by migrants, says, "The Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, also known as Remain in Mexico, a policy introduced in 2019 under the Trump administration, have resulted in more than 70,000 people being sent back into Mexico to wait for their U.S. court cases, often for extended periods in makeshift camps, where they are often denied basic health care and they face violence, rape, murder, and kidnappings by organized crime groups." Eva Moya says, "The risk continues to increase. Asylum seekers in Mexico are fearing for their lives, and smugglers are taking advantage of that. They will do anything to make profit from these people. It's human trafficking at its max." The Biden administration is finally ending the policy after court battles, but it's unclear how and when things will change substantially on the ground. Alma Maquitico, director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, said at the same time, Title 42, ostensibly a pandemic-related health measure introduced in 2020, closing border ports of entry and allowing the Border Patrol to summarily expel migrants without asylum hearings, has contributed to the deaths in Brooks County, Texas, and beyond. Alma Maquitico said, "Title 42 has led to a rise in deaths. People aren't crossing at cities anymore, but in more faraway, dangerous areas. They are dying in the desert." Eddie Canales also pointed to the rural, arid expanse. Contrasting it with its scorching desert namesake in California, he said, "This is the real Death Valley." He added, "The U.S. immigration system has failed. The government wants to blame the cartel, but not the policy that is creating this problem. The solution is to offer an ordered asylum pathway. You could fix this tomorrow." A spokesperson for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, which oversees the Border Patrol's 20,000 agents working between the land ports of entry, claimed the death toll was the fault of traffickers. They said in a statement, "Criminal organizations continue to recklessly endanger the lives of individuals they smuggle for their own financial gain, with no regard for human life. Despite these inherent dangers, human smugglers continue to lie to migrants, claiming the borders are open. The borders are not open, and people should not attempt to make the dangerous journey." Although Brooks County in Texas is about 70 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border, it has the largest Border Patrol checkpoint in Texas. Located along U.S. Highway 281, one of the few northbound highways along the hundreds of miles long South Texas border region, the checkpoint processes an average of 10,000 vehicles, traversing the busiest route from Mexico and Central America to the United States each day. According to Deputy Sheriff Don White, like other deterrence policies, the checkpoint, instead of reducing the number of migrants trying to enter the United States, has driven them into deadly routes. People smugglers, often known as coyotes, demand thousands of dollars to help migrants cross the Rio Grande on rafts, usually to McAllen, Texas, where they will hide in dirty, cramped, safe houses. Migrants will then be dropped off 50 miles north on sandy back roads, before being sent on a days-long trek across brutal terrain, where temperatures regularly exceed 100 degrees Fahrenheit during the ever-hotter Texas summers and drop below freezing in winter in order to avoid the checkpoint. According to Oscar Carrillo, a sheriff in Culberson County, Texas, which is also dealing with a surge in bodies, smugglers often send groups of migrants in camouflage gear as well as with backpacks of cannabis, allowing them to reduce the fees owed by delivering the contraband to a contact if they survive the journey. In February 2020, Oscar Carrillo apprehended a group of more than 50 people en route. Carrillo says they are given an itinerary like a cruise line, adding, "There's been a huge rise in attempts to cross, but it's a dangerous place. There are snakes, mountain lions. If they can't continue, they'll be left behind." For those who make it over the first hurdles in an attempt to reach densely populated cities in Texas, such as Houston, Dallas, and San Antonio, where they can live under the radar of the authorities, the risk is far from over. In June of this year, 53 migrants, mostly from Mexico, were found dead inside a sweltering tractor trailer on the outskirts of San Antonio, Texas, in what was the nation's deadliest smuggling incident along the U.S.-Mexico border to date. According to data from the Customs and Border Protection, CBP, since 1999, more than 7,500 migrants from Mexico, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and beyond are estimated to have died on the U.S.-Mexico border. According to Eddie Canales, most of these deaths can be attributed to heat stroke or to dehydration, who maintains 90 water stations out in the brush. He said, "Yet the real number of deaths is probably far higher due to limited data and a lack of support from federal authorities. Since 95% of land on the southern border of Texas and 99% in the Brooks County is private, ranchers and farmers on the remote plots, some as large as 50,000 acres, are often the ones that discover the recently or long-deceased people. Brooks County Sheriff's Office estimates it finds only one out of every five bodies. Eddie Canales says, "It's a burden that falls on volunteers. It's usually us who have to deal with the bodies." Yet Canales and his team of volunteers can only achieve so much. An analysis by the Center for Public Integrity found that more than 2,000 of the bodies of migrants recovered in the United States have not been identified. The National Institute of Justice has called the ongoing tragedy of missing persons, which leaves families unable to properly mourn, the nation's silent mass disaster.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion on how Arba'in procession will revive the Husseini movement all around the world, we have two guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Rouhani and Brother Habib. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, Brother and Habib.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me. It's always an honor and pleasure to be with you.
You're welcome, Brother. So for today's discussion, we want to talk about forming Shia community and the role of the majalis, or spirit say somehow the majlis or majalis refer to these gatherings and the ceremonies and the sessions that are held for commemorating the Ahlul Bayt, especially Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Sometimes we lose the main goal, we can say, behind holding a majlis.
Exactly, perfectly put, brother.
Yeah, for the a'immas, what is the majlis for? The majlis is not like, for example, a party. This is not a party, okay? This is not a parliament. This is not a party. This is not a friendly session. This is a majlis, and the majlis needs its own, we can say, prerequisites. And as I said, the organizers must, they themselves, be very much careful of who to involve and how to take, for example, the youth into the scene, the women into the scene, okay? And this is really important, I seem to hold the majlis for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the other a'immas. The Shias especially are known by the majalis for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. If something bad or, we can say, notorious happens during this majalis and it becomes viral, it is now the Shia face which is in danger. So we have to be very much careful. What are we talking about the topics, okay?
There's also something very important here. Uh-huh. Like how you said, my brother, this pulpit that the person, the speaker stands on is the face of our religion.
Yes.
Therefore, one of the most important things that a scholar, when he gets up on that pulpit, is to avoid lying on the tongue of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Al-kadhib ala Allah wa rasulihi. One of the biggest mistakes that happened these past years is that we have been accepting people to come and talk and speak. And what do they talk and speak? Things that have nothing in our sources, that are not available, not religion, based on dreams, based on theories that have no
solid,
no solid proof to it. It's very important. Why? Because it's the face of our religion. People are going to follow your words, dear scholar. Dear listeners to that scholar, don't always accept a knowledge from anyone or anything that you hear. Always keep it in mind that there might be a misconception, there might be a misunderstanding. Always ask for the source of it. If they bring up a saying, if they bring up a translation, if they bring up an explanation, an interpretation, ask for the source.
Without checking the references.
Check the references and whatnot. It's very important. Right. Because like how you said, my brother, it's the face of our religion.
Okay.
It's what we're going to teach our grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. And usually this majalis, we can say, might seem a little bit to be masculine in the face, okay? Because usually when it is taken, the videos are taken, the feminine aspect is hidden. But the women has also a role in inviting and encouraging the people into the majalis. The speakers that are women, speaking for the women in the majlis, okay, these are also... Isn't it, Sheikh? How do you find the role of the women in this majalis?
Of course, I think the role of women, and it's better to say mothers, are very much significant and important in holding this kind of majalis. And of course, they should observe the Islamic lifestyle, the Islamic rituals and rules and rulings that we have in all these majalis. But I think it is the mothers who bring up their children in a way to love Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. So that's why if a mother take the children to these majalis, their daughters, their sons, and that paved the grounds for that children to become true Muslims, to become true mu'min when they grow up. So that's why I think the role of mothers, the role of women in this kind of majalis is even much more important as compared to the fathers, because fathers are always busy working in those countries mostly. But mothers sometimes have this opportunity to bring up or to, let's say, train the true teachings and doctrines of Islam by taking them into this kind of majalis.
That's right.
Of course, they should hold sometimes this kind of majalis in their own small house and homes. That's also very much important. That's very much significant.
Okay.
Because this way, their children become familiar with the teachings and doctrines of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wassalam. And then later, they can go to the greater majalis and bigger majalis.
And mosques.
And on one day, they themselves will hold this majalis.
Yes, yes.
This is the role of
becomes a culture
of
holding a majlis for Imam Al Hussein. Yes, so every house could be a majlis, isn't it? Even with a small number of the people, we can hold a majlis.
I have two things in my mind that I want to bring up that might kind of feed like some kind of connection. The first one is that available. Sayyid Al-Khuyi puts it in his book Tafsir Al-Bayan. I forgot the source of it. Reciting the Quran in the house. Why? With a loud voice. Why? So the children can see the recitation of the Quran and get used to it. That's one thing to keep in mind. The second thing was the factor of when Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was asking one of the companions that came to him and told him that you remember Hussein, do you cry? He said, yes. Do your family see you and notice you that you are in great sorrow? He said, yes. He started praying for him. Rahamakallah, may Allah have mercy upon you and whatnot. And when you look at these two, making your family live this lifestyle, it's kind of, something that is being pushed by the Imam alayhum as-salam, that it's all right, push your family to live this kind of قُوَ أَهْلِكُمْ نَارَ, that verse, I think, if I said it correct or not, protect yourself and your families and your family from the fire of hell.
Yes.
And even those who state that al-amr bil-ma'ruf wa-nahy an al-munkar is not an obligation during the time of the occultation of the Imam, state that it is an obligation to do so with your family members because of this verse. How do you do it? It's like how the Prophet ﷺ said, tell them this action is recommended, this action is obligation, this action is prohibited, and what? Teach them. Put them in this environment. But of course, there has to be, that you're ready to put them in it, but they also have to be ready themselves. Sometimes we kind of start off too young with the children, or we start off wrong with the children. Because there's this video that I will give you this toy if you say that I don't love Imam Hussein. The child was like, I only love Hussein. I don't want the toy. One of my family members, my sister, she did it with her daughter, right? And she's like, all right, I don't love Imam Hussein. Just give me the toy.
These are children.
Leave them for 7 years. I believe that for 7 years, the child should be left by themselves. Let them themselves get intrigued. Okay.
I saw the footage of giving the dolls, and the toys. I think this is wrong. This is absolutely wrong, just playing with the psyche of the child.
Yeah.
And what a comparison, man. Just Imam al-Hussein to a doll.
To a doll.
And maybe I'm right, but statistically speaking, if this is on a true research and a test, The number of the guys who like, for example, the dolls and the toys, maybe more than Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Yeah. So why doing this at all?
My niece, my nephew.
Okay. Yeah. So this is wrong. This is not this is not a true way to invite the children to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. If you, as a father, as a mother, love Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, take part in the majlis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, then automatically your child will do so.
I've seen it with my daughter. Because okay. we were sleeping in Najaf, actually. This happened like 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And my daughter wanted water. She drank water. She didn't want to go to sleep. And we were sleeping in the same room. She wanted water. She was just, you know, annoying us to get to sell the water. My wife told her, no, I'm not going to get you water. She said, so I'm going to be like Imam Hussein.
Oh.
So it's in her mind. It's available in there. She's 2 years old. You look at her like, how do you get this? How do you learn this? They catch. They get intrigued.
Yes.
Let them be. Do not force it upon them until they're like they're 7 years old. When they become 7 years old, it becomes the where you have to teach them, where you have to let them know, you have to get them used to it, and so on and so on. So that's something just I wanted to point out too, because we've lived it. We've seen it actually a lot in our eyes. You know, children don't understand. Like I have this great scholar. He's a mujtahid.
Mm-hmm.
His grandchild.
Yes.
His grandchild in front of my eyes. He said, I want to fight with Yazid.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand what they're saying in most cases. So that's something to keep in mind. Like, don't force it upon them. Don't say that you're a failure, your child is a failure. Give them time. They will learn.
Yes.
And, you know, you just have to do it in the right manner.
And I think, again, like the Arba'in procession, the spirit of the majalis must be kept after the majalis too.
Yes.
When the majalis is done in a mosque or in a community somewhere else, okay?
You take some light. This light is supposed to light up
You take the light out, and then out of the majlis, you have to help the people, help the needy, help your neighbor. Day by day, the people, I think, even the non-Muslims, especially in the Western lands, might be interested in the Shia majlis too. That's all right. So, and the topics chosen for the majlis, Habib and Sheikh, what should be they? Only limited, for example, to the religious life, or it could be socio-political, cultural, I don't know.
And of course, this majalis and the topics or the discussions, lectures could be kind of multi-dimensional kind mm-hmm. of speeches and lectures, because our life is not only limited, for example, only to certain kind of mm-hmm. Rituals or rulings. And of course, our life, we need in our modern lifestyles to observe some of the things that social affairs, let's say moral affairs, cultural affairs, of course, political affairs. We have to actually teach our children, our young generation, our youth, also these kind of doctrines and teachings of Islam. We should not be limited only, for example, into ahkam. Some of the ulamas just teach ahkam, the children.
Yes.
So, of course, the ahkam is needed, but they should understand also their
history.
Main Islamic beliefs, history,
how to socialize,
the seerah, the moral conduct of the Ahlul Bayt, the social kind of conduct, the Prophet. All these things are needed to be taught to the people, mm-hmm. to be lectured, to be spoken about. Yeah,
I have this rule.
You have 2 or 3
picking
minutes.
Picking a lecture.
Okay.
Do not waste the people's time.
Mm-hmm.
Do not waste your time on this lecture. Mm-hmm. See the community, what it needs, what it's useful for them, what is helpful for them, where they have, where what they lack, give them. For example, some of them lack fiqh, halal and haram. You have to teach them that. You have to make your lecture about it, about that topic. Some of them lack history. Some of them lack theology. Some of them lack, for example, they have misconceptions. They don't know how to socialize. They are far away. They don't know the basics, for example. It depends on each one. There's the story available in the book, Jur'ayas Daryab, Sayyid Zanjani. It's a Persian book. Hopefully they'll finish off the Arabic translation. Very nice book. One of the stories available is the son of Sheikh Abbas al-Qummi, the person who complied,
Mufatih
al-Jinan. His son, Muhaddith Zadeh, says that I was giving a lecture one day. When I finished, I didn't prepare for the lecture. When I finished, I went down the pit pole. I went to sleep. I saw my father in the dream. He was kind of angry with me. I told him why. He said, you're wasting people's time. Don't waste people's time. Always pick a scholar who prepares. And as a scholar, as a person, the speaker, always prepare before you go on the pit pole.
That's all right. Pre-preparation is needed. That's right.
Not like me right now.
Okay.
Come without preparing. Very sorry. But inshallah, it's useful. it's not that much of wasting your time.
But you gave us references, man. This is good. Okay, thank you much, Brother Habib and Sheikh Rouhani for a nice elaboration regarding the role of the Majlis in forming Shia community, both inside and outside the Shia world. It is very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en-call-of-Islam page. In another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
Allahumma ja'al mahya ya mahya Muhammad wa al Muhammad wa mamati mamata Muhammad wa al Muhammad. I swear to Allah, you have shown us so much courage through the pain. You sacrificed your family and were killed thirsty, oh Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Drought was declared in 8 of England's 14 regions recently after a meeting of the National Drought Group, made up of ministers, civil servants, water companies and conservation groups. 5 water areas have so far put in place hosepipe bans, though farmers have called for more as ministers were briefed that farmers face the ruin of up to half their crops. We now present you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, England Failing to Invest in Water Networks to Avoid Future Droughts. The UK's infrastructure chief has warned England is failing to invest in the water networks needed to avoid a future of recurrent serious droughts, with current policies amounting to the government keeping its fingers crossed. Sir John Armitt, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, said, with more hot, dry spells interspersed with heavier rainfall, the current drought was a warning that water systems could not cope with the changing climate. He warned, investment is better than keeping your fingers crossed and relying on emergency measures. He said ministers could not prevent dry weather, but they could direct investment into infrastructure to cope with it, such as reservoirs and cutting wastage. Sir John Armitt added, the government should set out what degree of risk from drought they would see as reasonable for people to manage and expect. He warned water bills may have to increase to pay for the investment needed. Sir John Armitt told The Guardian in an interview, if you want greater resilience to drought, then you have to increase water bills or general taxation to pay for it. Drought was declared in 8 of England's 14 regions recently after a meeting of the National Drought Group, made up of ministers, civil servants, water companies and conservation groups. 5 water areas have so far put in place hosepipe bans, though farmers have called for more, as ministers were briefed that farmers face the ruin of up to half their crops. In several areas in the drought-stricken south of England, people have been forced to queue in the street as their water systems failed. In the village of North End in Oxfordshire, people have been relying on tankers. In and around Guildford in Surrey, handouts of bottled water began at the weekend after a pump failure at Netley Mill Treatment Works. In Everton in Bedfordshire, an already unreliable supply has been further threatened by drought. Hydrologists have claimed these are isolated incidents and that measures such as standpipes, a vivid memory for some from the last most serious drought in 1976, were highly unlikely to be needed in the current drought, as water companies were more resilient and better prepared than they were nearly half a century ago. The National Infrastructure Commission has estimated the cost of overhauling the UK's water networks at £20 billion by 2050, considerably less than the £27 billion the government has earmarked for new roads this Parliament, which campaigners say are not needed. Sir John Armitt said this cost was dwarfed by the cost of drought. He warned, in increasingly frequent droughts, you'll probably have to spend twice that much on bottled water from the back of lorries. He said new reservoirs should be strongly considered, despite the difficulty of obtaining planning permission, particularly in the southeast of England. In an interview with The Guardian, he noted water metering was also likely to be needed to encourage people to cut their usage of water, but the government is not keen. Sir John Armitt, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, called for a national debate on how to fund water improvements. The two Tory leadership candidates, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, have called for action but shied away from setting out clear proposals on investment. Sir John Armitt asked, "You have to balance water investment. Do you put it back through people's bills or through general taxation?" adding, "You have to ensure poor people are not being penalised." He said the role of water companies should be scrutinised. He noted, "There has been criticism of water companies paying dividends to investors. That has to be an issue for governments and regulators to decide." He added, "You can argue that water companies have invested too little. Going forward, the real challenge is for government to say what level of performance the public should be entitled to expect." People could have a substantial impact on water usage by changing their behaviour, for instance by not leaving taps running and running washing machines only on full loads. But Sir John Armitt warned this would not be enough alone, and the government under a new Prime Minister would face uncomfortable choices over the investment needed for new reservoirs and new infrastructure. He said, "There is a cost of living crisis, especially with energy bills, and people don't want to hear about water bills going up too." He added, "But one way or another, we have to find a way to pay for this new infrastructure." Sir John Armitt added, "Poorer households could be protected if the government stepped in to make the current billing systems fairer." England has experienced its driest July since 1911, with only about 10% of the average rainfall for the time of year in the south of England. The period since November has been the driest 8-month period in England since 1976. After a dry spell for almost 50 years, the United Kingdom is now being warned to expect flooding from thundery showers that will offer little relief from the drought. The flood alert follows days of extreme heat warnings and the official declaration of a drought after the longest 9-month dry spell since 1976. Meteorologists warned that downpours are the wrong kind of rain to tackle the drought and are more likely to lead to flash floods from water running off parched earth. The heat wave is forecast to break with a yellow warning for thunderstorms covering almost all of the United Kingdom, all of England and Wales, and most of southern and eastern England in the coming days. The Meteorological Office warned of torrential downpours and possible disruption in some spots, adding that homes and businesses could be flooded quickly and buildings damaged by floodwater. It also said power cuts were possible. The Environment Agency also warned that properties could flood and travel could be disrupted by surface water. John Curtin, the agency's executive director of operations, tweeted that the United Kingdom was in that twilight zone of having both flood and drought warnings. He said heavy thundery rain on parched and hard ground would lead to rapid runoff and heightened flood risk in the coming days. But this will in no way correct weeks of dry weather, so most of England will remain in drought. Professor Hannah Cloak, an expert in hydrology at the University of Reading, said the forecast rain was unlikely to be long-lasting or widespread enough to make a big difference to some exceptionally low levels in reservoirs and rivers. Dan Stroud, a forecaster at the Meteorological Office, said, "We're coming to the end of an extended very hot spell, and the ground has been baked, so it's extremely dry. The weather is breaking down into a mixture of heavy and thundery showers." Dan Stroud added, "And rain from really intense downpours will be unable to soak into the baked ground quickly. It's very difficult for the water to actually get in because it has to force the air out of the soil. So dry ground gets very quickly overwhelmed and we then get surface runoff." He added, "What we really need is a continuous period of light rain or drizzle just to gently re-wet the soil. Intense downpours are not exceptionally helpful. It's going to take a lot of rain over an extended period of time to actually recharge the aquifers and reservoirs." Dan Stroud added, "Almost anywhere was at risk of the impact of thundery downpours, but it was difficult to pinpoint exactly where." He said, "Scotland and Northern Ireland were most at risk. The risk develops initially across Wales and the southwest of England, and then more widely across England during the coming days." Rob Thompson, who conducted the demonstration, said, "Dry, parched ground doesn't let water in as effectively as already moist ground because the soil is resisting water entering. The water sits on the surface to run off down slopes or simply sit in a pool." Three water companies, Welsh Water, Southern Water and South East Water, have imposed hosepipe bans, while Yorkshire Water has announced that a ban will start on 26th of August, and Thames Water is planning one in the coming weeks.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.